such a pretty blues you have.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yes. Did you get the email we sent to the...
That's it.
Oh, you don't.
No. Look, when you're giving a talk, when I'm giving a talk, I am writing for 4 days.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's not me.
Good morning, everybody. Is that going to be loud enough?
Yeah.
Okay, super.
Do you intentionally have the blinds down, or can we put them up just a little?
You can put them up. You can do anything. I'm not projecting anything, so you can... I think the view is so beautiful up here that I love having them open. Frankly, I guess it makes it hard for the people that are sitting inside to look at the people that are sitting against the windows, but...
That would be great.
Does that make you happy?
I'm excited. All right, I'm excited.
How are you?
How you doing, Matt?
I'm good.
Your speaker today. Looking forward to that.
Well, I hope so. I'm so looking forward to it.
always.
It's missing. Oh, it's up there.
No, broken.
Well, the audience is dribbling.
What's that, Dorothy?
The audience is dribbling in.
Okay.
You want to be introduced? You want to do it yourself?
You want me to introduce you, or you want to do it yourself?
I can do it myself.
Okay.
We'll just wait. Our audience will dribble in. And we do.
Morning, David. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you.
A test will be what you think of me when I finish.
I always think well of you. So I'm gonna give him a few more minutes to come. My clock says 9:59. I hope y'all can understand my voice through the cup. Maybe I got cleaned up new one in their life. Yes, Chris.
Mac is going to introduce himself, but let's clap really loud anyway, just to get these people in here. You have to talk on the mic.
Oh. Dorothy, I thought I might wait until 10:05. Is that okay, or should I start now?
All right, we'll wait a few minutes.
I just say, you're the organizer here.
Go ahead. Whatever.
Wait. Well, I don't know. Maybe we should just do it, huh? I guess they'll figure out. It's kind of like a hologram, you know. Have you ever noticed that when you watch a movie, even if you come in late, you know what happened? Or at least when you get to be as old as I do, you do.
Well,
So some of you will be able to admire this sweater. It was knitted by none other than Joan Swift, an old member of the church. And I got to wear a sweater this morning. I'd like to remember her. So, this morning, what was the title of the talk? Reflections on Prison and Chaplain Ministry. Well, that was, 2 months ago, and it's morphed into, this morning, I want to talk about wisdom. I hope I have some interesting things to say about it for you. So, let me begin with a definition which I've cribbed from Wikipedia.
For those of you who don't know you as well as some people know you, did you want to say just briefly?
Well, what can I say? I've been a member of this congregation about 35 years. I was president of the congregation at one point. I've been to Star King. I've sat a year and a half of Buddhist meditation. And I have morphed from a computer scientist into a teacher and a chaplain. How's that? It surprises me sometimes when I look back at it, but... So, a definition of wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to think and act. Get the act in there. That's really important. Using knowledge, experience, understanding, common sense, and insight. Another kind of... It's a disposition, a habit or disposition. I like that word habit. To perform the action... Form an action with the highest degree of adequacy under any given circumstance and to avoid wrongdoing. Well, that wrongdoing, that's a big word. Interesting word. It implies the possession of knowledge or the seeking of knowledge to apply in any given situation or circumstance. It involves an understanding of people, objects, events, situations, and the willingness as well as the ability to provide our own perceptions, judgment, and action in keeping with the understanding of what is the optimal course for those actions. It often requires control of one's emotional responses so that the universal principle of reason can prevail to determine one's action. A shorter definition might be a disposition to find the truth coupled with an optimum judgment as to what actions should be taken. One last comment. The result of wisdom is behavior. I kind of like it's kind of like the 12th step, if you're familiar with that technology, which is something like, okay, now you got it. You're supposed to go out and share it. So, wisdom has also been studied. I've got a little reflection on that too. Some findings from a study by Paul Bates and Ursula Staudinger entitled "People Nominated as Wise: A Comparative Study of Wisdom-Related Knowledge." These are the kind of the consequences of it. From the ages 25 to 70, there is no correlation between age and wisdom. Well, I thought that was interesting. Wisdom seems to emerge from lessons gained through experience. It is possible to be quick on one's feet and skilled in processing complex information without reaching any sensible solutions to problems. Cultivating wisdom is a deliberate choice that a person can make regardless of age or intelligence. And here's how we do it. Here's some kind of reflections on the steps. Number one, one needs to see the world in shades of gray, not black and white. What would you say to a 15-year-old girl asking to get married? Here's an example of what might be considered a lower wisdom answer. No way. Marriage at that young an age will never last. It's just a crazy idea. Okay? Here's a more nuanced answer. We might call this higher wisdom. Well, Generally, marriage for 15-year-old girls isn't advisable. But there are situations where it doesn't fit. Perhaps in this instance, special life circumstances are involved, such as the girl has a terminal illness. Or perhaps she's lost her parents. Or she may live in a culture or historical period or raised in a culture with different values than ours. And in any case, one would have to be very careful about even the ways that one talked to a girl and consider her emotional states. I like that. I really like that. Second point is there has to be a balance between self-interest and the common good. As one psychologist puts it, wisdom and egocentricity are incompatible. People who've gotten where they are by taking other people's interests into account or even actually thwarting the interests of others would not be viewed as wise. There needs to be a healthy balance, though. The wise reject the assumption that the world is a win-lose or zero-sum place. They will find ways to benefit others that also advances their own objections. Notice the lining up here. It's not me or you, it's us. The wise are willing to question rules. Instead of accepting things as they've always been, wisdom involves asking, is there a better path? In Practical Wisdom, the psychologist Barry Schwartz and a political scientist Kenneth Sharp describe a Philadelphia man who was convicted of holding up a taxi driver with a gun. The sentencing guidelines call for 2 to 5 years in jail, but the facts didn't fit the case. The man had actually used a toy gun. It was his first offense. He just lost his job, and he stole $50 to support his family. The wise judge gave him a shorter sentence and permission to hold a job outside of jail during the day so that he could still take care of the family and still required him to pay back the $50. And lastly, the goal of wisdom is to understand rather than to judge. By default, many of us operate as jurors, passing judgments on the actions of others so that we can sort them into the categories of good and bad. Wise people resist this impulse, operating more like detectives whose goal is to explain people's behaviors. As psychologist Ellen Langer is fond of saying, behavior makes sense from an actor's perspective. But who else would do that? You know, acting as opposed to being real in your interactions with people. Over time, this emphasis on understanding rather than evaluating yields an advantage in predicting others' actions, enabling wise people to offer better advice to others and make better choices themselves. So, why am I so interested in this topic? I grew up in a very dysfunctional family who left me with a very distorted idea of what life was about and really no concept of what one does to take care of it. Another way of putting it is there was no modeling of a good relationship, what a good relationship looks like, or what even goes into making it good. One quick measure is that I have now been divorced 4 times, have 6 children by 3 different wives. I'll parenthetically add in there, my last marriage has lasted 20 years. It took me literally 60 years to figure out that something was wrong and to begin to learn some appropriate behaviors that would allow me to both take care of myself and all of those people who shared my life with me. About the time I figured out something was wrong, I picked up a book on meditation and quieting the mind, and somehow it so impressed me that I immediately signed up for a 3 or 5 day retreat at Spirit Rock. I suppose everybody knows about Spirit Rock? Nobody? Okay. Spirit Rock is a Buddhist meditation center over in San Rafael that is one of the 2 places that brought Vipassana into existence, or made it Vipassana available for people in the United States. And I, as I say, I've sat formal practice there about a year and a half now. But for that, I mean, and rather than signing up for what I thought was a meditation retreat, I'd actually signed up for what turned out to be a metta or loving kindness retreat. And that's how little I knew about it. So I immediately signed up for another real meditation retreat and began the process of trying to learn to meditate that's taken me about 14 years now. It's such a metaphor for life. You sit and watch it all go on around you, and you sit and you sit. But every now and again, some little thing begins to stick, or you know, you understand another nuance. But for me, the image is kind of like lichen growing on a rock. You know, it doesn't happen very fast, but it does. And I've got to the point now, sometimes I feel I really can meditate, at least for a little while. You've probably all heard the phrase that says, we study and teach what we most need to know. Another strand of my life has been, in fact, teaching. In 2002, I taught for a year as a volunteer at Richmond High. Then after that, I did a couple of years working with an after-high school program for kids who had not graduated. I can't say that I was particularly effective in either of these programs with the teens. I was way too white and uneducated in any sense of what it meant to be part of that different community, and only basically understood the kids' primary concern probably had a lot more to do with getting home safely at night than being educated. After teaching with teenagers for 3 years, a friend who was in charge of education for the Contra Costa County Jail System asked me if I would come and teach math, which is what I had been teaching, at West County Detention Facility in Panola, which I did for the next 6 years. Something was different here for me. I felt I was actually making a real connection with the men that I worked with there. I'm not sure how much math I was actually able to teach, but we in some sense enjoyed our time together, and some of them did actually even manage to pass their general education diplomas. But working in a jail environment is still difficult. There isn't any real organization. You can't ever actually plan on having a student in your class because nothing in the jail is repeatable. The men who have just arrived are focused on what will happen to them vis-a-vis the courts and don't have much attention for learning. I also felt that there was no sense of purpose or organization in their lives that provided any direction for what they did or how they lived their lives. I had a sense that what I was doing was neither really needed or valued from the jail administration's point of view, nor did I really understand how the general disorganization at the same time only underscored the disorganization of the individual's lives as well. So the next thing that happened to me, I said I'd been at Star King trying to learn to be a minister. I wasn't old enough in those days. I took a pulpit for 3 months and killed myself trying to write sermons that, you know, I didn't have anything to say. Now I'm standing in front of you, and I definitely do. Anyway, the next thing that happened to me in my journey towards wholeness was that I took some chaplaincy classes. A Buddhist one is actually part of the GTU. One of the wonderful things about that class was that it introduced me, you know, the class experiences, go see how chaplaincy happens in other places, and they took me into San Quentin. And because of that San Quentin exposure, I further took a class at Pacific School of Religion in prison ministry taught by the Catholic chaplain at San Quentin. One of the things I'd noticed at San Quentin was a deeper sense of organization than I'd ever felt in the jail setting. In jail, nobody knows what's going to happen, what will happen next, or even if they'll decide it's worth getting up to go to class. But the men in prison seem to really have developed a sense of order and responsibility for themselves that allowed them to be present in what I had seen to be some very powerful programs. I still remember my first visit to a program called GRIP, or Generating Rage into Power. The 50 men in the program were mostly second-degree murderers, most of whom had already been incarcerated for more than 15 years. To understand what's important here, second-degree murder is a crime of passion rather than a crime of premeditation. The implication of this is that each man had done something probably of no more than a few minutes or seconds duration that had already cost them 15 or more years in prison. And let's reflect on the word penitentiary. It comes from the Catholic monastic tradition, Middle Ages, and was a place where unruly monks were sent to reflect on their unruliness. So these men have been reflecting on their lives for a very long time. A wonderful man named Jacques Verdun has developed a program there that helps them come to terms with both what they've done and at the same time learn to master their violent behavior and replace it with an attitude of mindfulness and emotional intelligence. One of the things I've included on my list of resources are two videos from the GRIP program. One in particular that I really love is the video of one of the GRIP graduation classes. I mean, there must have been 100 people there had come in for the graduation. Great music, intense enthusiasm for the men who spent a year doing this work of growing up. You might, if you look very carefully, even see me in some of the crowd scenes. One of the requirements for the prison ministry class was that as part of the class experience, we were expected to attend the weekly restorative justice classes held in the Catholic chapel at San Quentin to really get a feel for what prison ministry was like. And let me parenthetically say one part of prison ministry, little interjection here. I'll just mention the other one. We call it walking the tiers. The tiers being the floors of cells in which the lockdown inmates actually live. I cannot but note the connection to the word tears, as in weeping. For those of you who are unfamiliar with what restorative justice is, let me describe it to you. RJ starts with the concept that whenever the fabric of society is broken, the people most concerned with its repair are, in fact, what we call from the vocabulary of attributive justice, the victim and the offender. Let me observe that in the restributive justice system, the victims have many questions about why and how the offender did what he or she did. But the retributive process is only concerned with what took place and never addresses the victim's concerns at all. In the restorative model, the victim and offender are co-responsible for doing whatever is needed to repair what's been broken, including everything from why did you do it, to what are you willing to do about it now? So in the restorative justice program, we have two classes of 100 men each who come in on Wednesday nights and Thursday nights. We sit in reflection circles of about 10 men each and study a book entitled The Little Book of Restorative Justice for Prisoners. We read the text together and share our thoughts and reflections on it. We also watch videos of actual meetings between victims and offenders, and again share in circles what we've seen and heard. I would characterize my role in this process both as a witness and at the same time, I'm just a member of the circle. We're all reading the book together and reflecting on what we've learned, what we've done, and what we might do to alleviate what we have done, what harm we've caused. And I, just like any other member of the circle, can share both my wisdom and my reflections. And I also get to hear their wisdom and their reflections. If you've ever done 12-step work, it's kind of analogous to the sharing of stories in that context. One of the things that I perceive happens to the men in restorative justice is that it is one of the ways that can literally open the door to wisdom. You see men come into the circles who have little or no experience in relationship in their lives. And now they're in prison, their primary relationship is with the system that puts and keeps them there. But when you begin to talk about relationships with real people and are beginning to understand the dynamics of a relationship, to me, it looks like a new experience for them. But like any new idea, it takes some time to begin to really understand what's going on. But with the stimulus of these weekly experiences and the ongoing study, you can watch the understanding build. If you have a relationship with your victim, which is where we start, then obviously your victim has a relationship with you. And if you have a relationship with your victim, you also have a relationship with the victim's family. And if there's a relationship with the victim's family, there's a relationship with your family. And once that is understood, and from there, it's a small step to an understanding that one's existence is tied up in the whole web of relationship. And once that is understood, you also have a responsibility for all of these relationships. And to me, it absolutely leads to the beginning of the wisdom process. I mean, I can see it on people's faces. Doesn't mean that one is instantly wise, but it does mean that one is now at the beginning of accumulating wisdom. So a little more about restorative justice. It is also the process where the stakeholders are affected by an injustice, have an opportunity to discuss how they've been affected by that injustice, and decide what should be done to repair the harm. With crime, restorative justice is about the idea that because crime hurts, justice should heal. It follows that conversations with those who have been hurt and with those who have inflicted the harm must be crucial to the process. In the restorative process, citizens who've been affected by crime must take an active role addressing the crime. Although law professionals have a secondary role in facilitating the process, it is the citizens who must take the majority of responsibility in healing the pain caused by the crime. The process of restorative justice thus shifts the responsibility from addressing crime from the state to the individuals. This process is already in use formally in three California counties, including San Francisco, as a parallel to their county justice systems. Schools are beginning to use it for disciplinary process because it gives the students both a voice in and an understanding about the implications of their actions. Several counties use restorative methods in their juvenile justice systems. Oakland and the Napa school districts have it in their school disciplinary systems. And Oakland, in fact, will be the site in 2007 for the National Association for Community and Restorative Justice Convention. And I also even know about a murder case in Florida that was actually tried under restorative rules. I mean, just fascinating to me. Another current example of an example where restorative principles would probably have helped a great deal is the court case surrounding the Stanford swimmer who the judge sentenced to 6 months in county jail for raping a woman. How differently that case would have been handled if it had been adjudicated with a restorative process rather than a judicial one. So now I want to take a couple of minutes to think about ways which help us stay in contact with these ideals. Because remember, wisdom is one of the ways we can think about it is ideals about how we want to act. I'd like to go back to Lillian Kozel's example that she used here last week, picturing the brain as an iceberg floating in water. Remember the iceberg? 1/5 sticks out of the water and is visible, and we might think of it as our conscious mind, but the other 4/5 are hidden below the water, not seen. We might think of them as representing the non-conscious accumulations of our experience. You know, our parents, our class, our education, our race, our community, our sex. You know, all of those things that we've accumulated over our lives. And since it's 4 times larger, unless we're fairly conscious, probably controls a lot more of how we really react or stimuluses than we realize. In the relationship with our behavior, for instance, with my own behavior, for instance, I often find myself reacting in ways that don't contribute to what I know with that visible or conscious 1/5 of my brain. If I'm tired or pressed for time or hungry or just feeling crappy, then I find myself more critical and less responsive in ways that I'll probably have to go back and apologize for later. And especially when something happens when I'm not happy about and I want to talk about it, my voice will take on a sharp edge that implies I'm here to change you rather than to let you know about my concern and see if we can work it out. Remember her acronym, DIE? Describe it, analyze it, explore it. The real purpose of this to me isn't so much that you pull DIE out of your head and go down the list, but it's more so that you can stop for a moment and allow that top fifth of your mind to come into focus and give it time for your wisdom process to come online and help you deal with the situation. After 75 years of trying to do this, I've begun, and I use the word begun because I'm talking about very old and deep patterns, to sometimes manage to actually respond to a place out of wisdom. I was talking with my therapist the other day about it, and he talked to me about a way of thinking that I thought was that really seems useful to me, and I find it useful as I use it. When something negative happens to us, we're already unhappy about it. Okay? And I've experienced enough to know that I'm not necessarily going to even get what I want out of the interaction anyway. So I'm still unhappy. So his response to that was, okay, so let's restructure the situation so that you can get a positive response out of it rather than the negative one that you are already imagining. So if you can find something to do that you think is positive in the situation, you can give yourself a metaphorical pat on the back for it. For instance, I start to be critical about something, and I remember that I need to speak softly and without tension in my voice. I get to give myself a gold star. After all, I've just taken a step that's positively reinforced what I want, the behavior that I want, and negatively reinforced the behavior that I don't want. Here's another example I learned from one of my RJ guys in the prison. If a situation starts to get a little confrontational, his response is just to say to himself, "Really?" with a question mark, and walk away. At the end of the day, his behavioral reinforcement is to count up the number of times he said, "Really?" Positive reinforcement. It's a good thing to remember. Another way to open yourself up to this kind of wisdom comes from the 12-step world, from an organization called Adult Children of Alcoholics and, wait for it, this is the end of the title, and Dysfunctional Families. Because there are many dysfunctional things that can contribute to this. And I, as a matter of fact, am a member of codependency group. You know, you got AA, called CODA is the short term for it. There's CODA, and then there's also ACA, which is Adult Children of Alcoholics. They don't keep the dysfunction, just for the names. The definition of codependency is behavior designed to keep your world safe by controlling other people. I mean, that's what we do when we get uncomfortable. We want to control the situation so that we can feel safe. It comes from having controlling parents. It comes in many ways. It comes from having controlling parents that teach children how to do it. It comes from not having any parents. It comes from trying to learn from parents who themselves are out of control, or even parents that don't care. It can come because a child is forced to parent someone who isn't capable of parenting. And I postulate that codependent behavior is a major component of criminal behavior. All the 12-step organizations publish their own versions of what they refer to as the Big Book. I found these books to be veritable troves of information about their individual subjects. And I would like to take a few minutes to introduce you to a list of behaviors that a codependent might exhibit from the Codependence Anonymous Big Book. I'm talking about them here not because we're codependents, but for me, being familiar with them is part of my personal wisdom process. This isn't a complete reference, a complete list, but I have a reference to it on the handout page that I would like to send you if you put your email address on the page at the back. So there are four sets of these things, what they call patterns. The first one are what they call patterns of denial. Minimize, we as codependents, these are things that we, traits that we exhibit or ways that we cope with life. Minimize or alter or deny how we truly feel. Lack empathy for the feelings of others and their needs. Think that they can take care of them. Think that we can take care of ourselves without any help from others. Mask our pain in various ways, such as anger or humor or isolation. We express negativity and aggression in indirect or passive ways. We don't recognize the unavailability of those people to whom we are attached. Now, notice that these lists are very interesting because they contain, you know, behaviors to me that fall in the same category, but which are negatives of one another. To minimize how I truly feel, and a lack of empathy for other people. I just am fascinated by. Maybe we've all learned as, you know, to use these tools ourselves in our, you know, in our own lives. It's just that some people have to actually depend on them. So another one are called low self-esteem patterns. We judge what we think or say or do harshly, and we're never good enough. We value others' approval of our thinking, feelings, and behavior over their own. I'm the expert. Wow, I feel good. You know, I'm giving this speech this morning. I'm great. That kind of stuff. We don't perceive ourselves as lovable and worthwhile people. We have difficulty admitting our mistakes. We need to appear to be right in the eyes of others, and may even lie to look good. We perceive ourselves as superior to, we see ourselves as superior than others. Notice, some people it's like we're not as good as, some people is we are better than. We have difficulty getting started, meeting deadlines, and completing projects. I mean, I don't know, maybe that's also part of my attention deficit stuff, probably, or something. So I have trouble setting boundaries. You know, I didn't even know there was a word called boundaries in my growing up. I was taught in a family of complete codependency. You know, don't mention your father's drinking. So, compliance patterns. We tend to be extremely loyal, but without any judgment when that loyalty needs to end. We compromise our own values and integrity to avoid rejection. We're afraid to express our beliefs, opinions, feelings when they differ from someone else. We accept sexual attention when we want love. Boy, do I know a lot of people where that's true for. And it's fascinating when people, once in my coder group, when you see somebody get it, it is really fascinating to watch them work with it. I can't go into more stories than that, but it is so part of the reason that I do what I do is because I'm growing up and I'm fascinated to be with other people who are growing up, I guess. So the last one of the way we actually do the control. We demand that our needs be met. That happens to me a lot. We attempt to convince others of how they feel. We will give people gifts and favors when we want their influence. And we have to feel needed even to be in a relationship with somebody. We use blame and shame to exploit other people emotionally. These are just such, I don't know, such fundamental processes. I think they're fascinating things to, you know, what we're talking about with wisdom is to bring this stuff out of our unconscious and into our awareness. And that's why I'm talking about it. If you look carefully, these are, in fact, control behaviors that one must learn to be a successful criminal. But let's reflect that these are only behaviors, and behaviors do not make us who we are. Behaviors are, in fact, learned traits, and they can therefore be changed. One of the things we emphasize with the men in San Quentin is that you are not what you have done. But doesn't that apply to us all? There are always things in our past that we would, I'm sure at this point in our lives, rather that you did not know about. But to change, you need two things. You have to have a reason for change, and you have to have a way to change. And what I've been talking about is, with my restorative justice, is one of the, like putting the reason to change in front of people. I mean, there are so many. I remember that there's an infinite number of things. I mean, our intuition may someday, the thought comes, oh, I need to change this now. So we're not, but there is also this, the change that I'm interested in, this educational change. I need to know more than I know. I guess that's what I'm really interested in. Let's see. Did I mention the word penitentiary before? Okay. Sometimes I don't get the thing completely edited. Anyway, I just, my reflection, 10 to 25 years is a long time to reflect on one's behavior and its consequences, especially the parts where one is absent from, like the death of a beloved relative or the lives and the events in the lives of the children that they cannot be present for. There has to be a strong reason to change. And I see it, if it hasn't already happened, as one of the openings to the source. And I see it, if it hasn't already happened, as one of the openings to the source of wisdom. One of the measures of this in this environment is that the older a man is when he gets out, the less likely he is to come back. Age is the only real predictor of recidivism rates that I think anybody really understands. Now I want to talk about forgiveness, which is, when something happens, I want to talk about the forgiveness that happens between victims and offenders, between murderers and their victims. I mean, just to kind of go to one end of the spectrum. Let me interject here that there are a number of people who cannot let go of their fright or injuries. Victim rights groups are still very much a presence in our lives. While we're trying to legislate shorter sentences, whenever something that is declared heinous happens, you'll hear calls for longer sentences. Again, I'll point back to the situation with the Stanford guy. I've seen a lot of, stuff like, the judge needs to be thrown out and the guy should be put in prison for years. Rather than reflecting on, what's really going to happen? The guy is now a felon for life. There are rules about what a judge can and can't do and what is expected of him to do that we, as people outside the court, don't understand. All of these other things that come into a situation. But let me go on with my favorite forgiveness story. You may have heard me speak about it before. It's a story about Linda White and her granddaughter, Amy. Linda is now 70-plus grandmother, and her now 20-year-old daughter had, 20-year-old granddaughter had the daughter abducted, raped, and murdered by a couple of teenage boys. The whole story is told in a video entitled Meeting with a Killer. It's a story of the grandmother and granddaughter meeting with Gary Brown, the young man who'd killed their respective daughter and mother. Remember what I said earlier about victims wanting to know about what happened? Linda, shortly after the murder, began to work know, sort of like I have done, though for different reasons, with prisoners in the Texas state prison system. She went on to get her PhD in psychology and philosophy to facilitate her understanding of the issues that she had to work with. They had also at that time just set up a program in Texas where a victim could actually ask for and meet with the consent of the offender, to actually have a meeting. And Linda's PhD thesis was the evaluation of this program. She thought the program so successful that she decided to use it to meet one of the young men who'd murdered her daughter. Parenthetically, the other young man is in an institutional for the criminally insane. And since she had done the study, they decided to use it as a case study and video the entire process, including the preparation by both parties and the actual meeting itself. That's what you'll see in the video. You meet a young man who is literally not raised by anybody and who speculates that he would be dead at this point if he hadn't already been put in prison. His warden describes his life as mostly antidepressant drugs, a number of suicide attempts, and television. Remember the penitentiary thing. He's been in life for a number of years, and you watch him now struggle with his own remorse in this process of preparing for this meeting. In the meeting, you watch Linda and her granddaughter go through the process of meeting and asking the questions. Then you watch as the young man asks what they would think if he were ever to be paroled. And you watch as Linda puts her hands on him and tells him to get all the education that he can. And at the end, you see the three of them smiling, hugging, and taking photographs of each other to remember the meeting by. And this is only one of the examples of huge forgiveness that I've met in this work that I do. We show this story to every class that we take through the RJ program. And about a year ago, I actually had Linda come to one of the Saturday programs that we do to introduce people from outside San Quentin to the work that the men are doing inside. I've got another repetition in here. When she finished, they took the program. My closing sentence here is, she is a beautiful and deeply religious woman, and now my friend. And I cannot describe for you, it still affects me, what a poignant day it was for all the men who actually got to meet her. And at the end of the day, she described this meeting with the men in San Quentin as one of the most important days of her life. And I still remember her closing comment. I feel as if I should have taken off my shoes. We've been walking on holy ground. Gary is now out of prison and on parole, living in a small town a few miles from Linda. He has a small job and is okay. But he will never fully recover from his early childhood experience. And after the experience with the love and compassion that Linda and Amy showed him, I'm sure he is never going to be a danger for anyone now. And when I really get cynical about this whole process, my comment is, I think we put the wrong generation in jail. That's a parenthetical aside. I'm not cynical. There's another fantastic forgiveness story about a Montana sheriff who, in the process of trying to stop a bank robber, is shot and terribly wounded as he shoots and wounds the bank robber. So much so that he had to retire from his job as a police officer. As a matter of fact, the two men are lying on gurneys next to each other as the doctors are working on them after the shooting in the emergency room. His reflection on this was that after 10 years of hating the man who'd taken away his profession, the energy that he was using was in fact killing him. And he elected to go and meet the man in prison. And as a result of that meeting, he not only befriended the man, he went to the parole board to argue for his release. And, I mean, there are other stories. There's a story about a woman in Chicago whose son was murdered by a young man. In court, she stood up and she said to the young man, "I'm going to kill you." He was in jail. She started sending him little boxes of cookies. And then she sent him reading material. Then she sent him Bibles. Then she started visiting him in jail. And when he got out, she adopted him. That is wisdom. How she repaired that hurt. You can tell these stories are. Here's another one. About a month ago, a Spanish guy from my restorative justice group, who'd been in prison for 40 years, a Spanish-speaking guy. I'm sensitive. I'm not going to call him a Mexican because I don't know what country he's from. He had a little bit of a Spanish accent, and he hung out with the Spanish guys, and I knew him. He was a wonderful man. Anyway, he found out on Monday that he was to be paroled on Thursday. And at the Wednesday night restorative justice meeting, we asked him to share his thoughts with us. This is what he said. "The reason that I'm being paroled is because what I've learned here in restorative justice, to convince the board that I wouldn't be a problem when they let me out." He didn't mean that he learned set phrases or a pattern to convince the board with, but that he had learned to speak from the heart with his heart. Wow. Growing up.
10:50.
Oh, God. Okay, one more story. Kaiser Hospital. I meet this lady in a bed. She's obviously rough. You know, she's old. And, you know, you can kind of tell she's had a rough life. You know, you do this conversation thing with them, and I found out she was a bus driver. Well, you know, you go on with the conversation. I found out she was a school bus driver. Then she told the story of the day she retired. The school that she'd been driving the bus for quit that day, stopped. The whole day was a celebration of her presence in their lives. The staff, the teachers, the students, the ex-students, the parents all came to celebrate her life with them. Wow. Okay. Remember that part of wisdom comes from experience and knowledge. I want to invite. There's the leader, and then there's the ad. I want to invite you to come to San Quentin and meet some of my friends. They're quite an interesting group in all kinds of different ways. I know artists and musicians and bank robbers and fathers of gay children. I know men who are Hawaiian, Hmong, Cambodian, Protestant, Catholic, Arabic, Filipino, South and Central American, European, African. I know men who have people in San Quentin that they're related to by murder. Wow. You know, generally when guys come into San Quentin who've murdered somebody, they're likely to be murdered inside the prison for themselves. These guys don't. I know men who are women. I know men who are trying to figure out what life is all about. And I know men dedicated to keeping kids from being like they are. I know wise men, and I know men trying to get that way. It's an exciting community to be with. There's an injunction in the Bible. Continue to remember those in prison as if you are together with them there in the prison. And those who are mistreated as if you yourselves are suffering. I see this as a call, frankly, to wisdom. A call to come to a place we wouldn't think of coming, and opening ourselves to that knowing and the riches that it might bring. One of the reasons I am here to be present with the other. One of the reasons I am there is to be present with the other wherever it is. I read the newspapers and watch television now and find my heart and find heartfelt reactions to all the misery that I see. And I know that my presence in this place brings something of value to both the people who are there and from the people who go there. So that's the advertisement. We do a quarterly program on Saturdays where we invite people to come in and spend half a day with the men inside, sit in the circles with them, share a meal and friendship. Ask me and I can help you come. If at some point you are more curious, we run a weekly program on either Wednesday or Thursday nights. We would really love to have more outsiders, particularly people who are different, you know, people of color. Please come and attend. You can sit with one circle or move around. You will make friends and hear stories and learn new things. You will also share your wisdom with the men as the men share theirs. Talk to me if you want more information. Sign up on the email list sometime. Thank you for taking the time to listen to me. We have a few minutes for questions.
Only a few.
We got 5 minutes for questions.
I hope you come back every year. Thank you so much.
Okay.
I was wondering about how they handle racism. If this ever comes up in their discussions, I know it's hard for everyone.
The prison itself is racially segregated, but when you come into the restorative justice groups, and I can't speak for all the other programs, you cannot say that there is one corner of the room there's one particular color. And I see white men talking to black men. I don't even think about color in there. I see the face of somebody that I know and like.
Thank you. I really enjoy the talk about restorative justice, and I've had a strong reaction to the swimmer.
Can you hold the mic a little closer?
Yes. I've had a strong reaction to the swimmer's stories, and I'm wondering how restorative justice might have worked for him and the kind of time frame.
It isn't for him. It's for them.
It would
mean that the young man and the young woman would actually have to sit in the circle together and work it out together. That way they would, and they have to both approve of that process. You know, it's got to satisfy both people.
How would it begin?
It would begin by the victim probably saying why she felt the way she did, and then she gets to ask, and what are you willing to do about it? What are we willing to do about it? And I'm here to have this conversation with you about that. I mean, the story that I told you about from Florida, it was two families where children had married, and the young man killed his wife, and the two families wanted him to, do something to happen, but they did not want him to be murdered. And they asked the state of Florida to do it in a restorative, with a restorative rules so that they could be present and part of that process, and that's what happened. The state did have was sitting in that circle, and they did have the requirement that he actually do jail time. But he was not executed. I mean, you know, this is kind of like the one about the guy stealing $50 to support his family, I think. I mean, that's where we get to. Okay, I think we probably need to go into service now. If anybody wants to stop and talk with me personally, I will stay here for some more time.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Some behavior might be learned. But there's a lot of behavior that's instinctive. What you have to learn is when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate.
Well, we learn that behavior instinctive. That's shown in our brains. We learn it as children, yes.
But my dog, you know, I walk the dog and he meets another dog. And they have a fixed behavior. They all do it. You know,
they
stick nose to nose.
They don't have the neocortex that we do. What we're doing is we're trying to evoke our neocortex. And you're right, we're doing it. If I'm hungry, I'm going to be pissy.
Yes.
I mean, that's instant.
How do you turn off your recorder? Thank you for what you do. Yeah.